Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, the one, the only, Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
We've got a guest rejoining us, Tim. It's been a while, I think since 2018, I believe, in here, and she has adopted her actual name again. Now, she's re-released her book. This is the second edition, updated edition. Originally, she joined us, a book called Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences. Our guest is Anna Maria Manalo, and the book has been re-released now this year with updated information and under her actual name, not her pen name. Anna, it's great to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
What made you decide to use a pen name the first time you wrote the book? Were you afraid of being judged or chastised for being open about your paranormal experiences?
Well, that is partly true. The circumstances were rather complicated that led to the pen name. The one thing I know is that I was still working, and now that I'm retired, I can speak. I worked at a public school, and I don't know how much you know about public schools as far as being very conservative. I functioned as a guidance counselor with a pretty huge caseload at the time. I think by the time I retired last year, I had about 387 students under, my roster, which is a lot. But what led to it was I had a conversation with my former publisher because of the fact that I was a UFO investigator for MUFON for a couple of years, involved in the 2008 UFO flap, if I might digress. And we had some pretty prominent cases. One of them, or actually two of them, led to a possible TV pilot right after the flap, which aired Thanksgiving of 2008. During that time, you know how it is with Thanksgiving, people are home. They're, getting together with family, they're eating, celebrating, and some of them sit down and they watch TV. So in the process of that, there were a couple of people from my district who happened to see me in one of the episodes. That led to quite a bit of controversy.
Yeah.
And I am not kidding. You can't make this stuff up, as they say. I was called in after Thanksgiving the following week into the main office, HR. And I was asked if I knew how many students had seen the show. And I said I couldn't even begin to conjecture. All I know is it was shown on the Discovery Channel, yada, yada, yada. And they said, well, quite a bit because we're getting phone calls from parents.
Wow. Parents who probably were the ones actually watching the show with their children. Because they have a fascination, but then are outraged and offended that their guidance counselor is on there. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's weird.
So I guess the time was not right for that type of information to go through. I mean, even though we had tons of witnesses, multiple people that were involved, and you could see from the show that these people were pretty logical, pretty down-to-earth people. But it was one of those things that it was delivered to me rather sternly that I needed to discontinue what I was doing. So with that in mind, when I sat down finally, and this is like years later, since then I've written screenplays, things of that nature, gone on to other investigations, went overseas a number of times, finally had a conversation with Philip Mantle, whom is pretty prominent in the UFO field.
Yeah.
And he said, how do you want to digest this into a book? And I said, well, I'm not really sure, what angle I want to approach it, but I do want to know that I want to write down all the different things that have happened over a lifetime. At that point, over a lifetime, meaning from where I grew up in the Philippines, which is my native country of origin, to the present time, and this was back in 2017. I don't know that I'm ready because I'm still working to put it under my real name. And that's how Adele was born.
So, now, that's fascinating to see that there was this kind of strange de-evolution of how you have to approach being open about these things and, you know, this high strangeness. Now, have people now in your community, knowing that you're into this, have they been more open with you about their own experiences, or is there still kind of this weird prudish manner to it?
Well, you know, prudish is a good word to use. I would say that after the show aired in the community that I live in, which is rather disparate, you know, it's about an hour away from the community that I serve as a counselor, there's quite a difference in thinking. And not to disparage the other community, I just sense that it's because it's a public school, it tends to be more conservative than other venues. People have approached me on the street and have recounted stories. You know, even when I'm going overseas, I tell people who are either in my tour group or people we meet, and it leads to other stories. And this book is an amalgamation of that, how telling a story has opened other people up to tell their own experiences, whatever those experiences are. And it really led to this book being put together, because these are all from different countries that I've traveled to. And these are just people that are coming forward about what they've experienced, that they didn't want to tell other people necessarily, but because they heard me talking about my own and other people's, they ventured to talk about their own firsthand experiences. So in that manner, it has opened up more people to approach me. I know in my own immediate neighborhood, there is a gentleman who is very receptive to alternate realities, the idea that there are ETs, you know, that some might even, in fact, already be here. And some people are receptive to the idea of the afterlife, ghosts and hauntings and things of that nature. So in that manner, in a more relaxed setting with people who are coming from different walks of life, I see more receptivity. Is it the majority? I don't know that I can say that. But I would say a better handful than before.
Fascinating stuff. Let's, for listeners that didn't get a chance to hear about your first book, Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences, and now it is out, and again, we have a link for that book on today's program guide, folks. So you can find it. If you are having trouble accessing that link, just go to darknessradio.com, click on our shop tab, our store tab there, and it'll open up. You can go into our Amazon store and it'll be in our paranormal book section. So you can find it very easily there. How long have you had strange paranormal activity occur around you?
I think I was in a neighborhood, first of all, that had a lot of history. And this was in a very small town in the Philippines, about an hour, I would say about an hour, 15 minutes outside of Manila. For the audience who's not familiar with the Philippines, it's composed of islands. The largest one is called Luzon, L-U-Z-O-N. And within that is the largest city, which is the capital of Manila. Where I lived was a suburb called San Juan, just like the one in Puerto Rico, and it's situated south of the center of, I should say, actually southeast of the center of Manila. During the time in the early 60s, a little bit of history here, if I might digress, there was a lot of people who were moving into the suburbs of Manila. For one reason or another, one of those neighborhoods happened to have people who were actually buying lots, you know, open land to build their own homes. One of them happened to be a family member. And then the one across the street was a gentleman who was of means. He was a medical doctor, bought a huge piece of land. Into this neighborhood we settled, people not realizing that we were settling on soil that actually had bodies of Japanese soldiers and people who were massacred during World War II. So right. World War II pretty much is the same in the Philippines as it was in Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, it began in 1938, ended approximately in 1945. And then during that time frame, you know, a lot of massive changes happened right after the war. People were rebuilding mm-hmm. what had been destroyed. So I think in an effort to try to rebuild, people didn't realize what it meant to build on soil that had a history, a violent history like that. And this book covers, I would say, in the first 24 chapters, documentation of one particular family who had repeat encounters. I happened to live across the street. I was myself a child. And across the street, there was a child as well who was going through all that. And I named her in the book as the kind of like a protagonist and all the experiences that happened to them in the vicinity. Even as far as like six blocks away, there were all kinds of hauntings. This is really a documentation of one particular family in the first half of the book and all the kinds of infestations they went through. And Dave, when I say infestation, usually there's three faces, and I'm going by, the books on demonology. Some people might have a different interpretation. I interpret it this way for one reason, because the witness herself told me that the creature at the window that her father saw actually bent and effervesced like the wind when confronted with a cross, a crucifix.
Oh, so it yielded to Christianity. It yielded to this
a Christian symbol.
Right, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, when you look at the literature from a Roman Catholic point of view, and this country is very Roman Catholic, about 99.9%, the interpretation bends that way, but then you also have some documentation to show that whatever it was might have been demonic. It shows like a Mothman. If you think about the Point Pleasant encounters that led to the collapse of the Silver Bridge. We'll never know really if that caused the collapse or whether it was predicting a collapse, but whatever this thing was, if you want to interpret it differently, it predicted a suicide of a gentleman who at the time was only 24 years old.
Very strange. Now, I know we're kind of rolling into touching on what the new book that you're working on is covering. And okay. We'll continue that. I also want to jump back into some of the other stories, that have led you along this path and some of your experiences, so we can catch people up from 3 or 4 years ago if they didn't have a chance to hear that original interview. The new book, okay. Just so we're clear, will be coming out, what you're hoping, by the end of the year or so. Is that right?
I would say towards the late fall, probably into sometime in November.
Okay. The Way Through the Woods.
Just to be conservative.
Right. Yeah. The Way Through the Woods, A Child's Escape Through the Haunted Forests of World War II Germany. And we do, we'll have a link up for that when that book is out and available. And we'll remind people when it becomes available. I'm sure that Anna will let us know so we can post links about it at that time. So I'm sorry, go ahead. So you've got, that's definitely strange in that this creature would yield to a religious element to something with a Christian background. That how did they react to that aspect of this? And I mean, it's got to give you a sense of peace, because at least you know there's something that would fend a creature off like this.
Yeah, and from what I understand, it fended it temporarily. It was not a permanent situation, and I think that when people delve into the research of people who are possessed or being infested by these types of negative entities, the infestation perseveres. It's very, very hard to remove them from the home or if they're haunting a person. I mean, there could be two kinds of hauntings. It could be a home that's being haunted, or it could be actually a person that's being followed. In this case, from what I know, it sounded to me like it was a person that was being followed, and that was the father of the girl. It did not end with that. Several months later, you know, things did happen. I won't disclose too much since, you know, that's really the book. But to make a long story short, it lasted almost a lifetime before this person was able to get rid of whatever that was. And we never will know. I mean, I've been on a number of shows, and there's all kinds of different theories as to what it is. Is it really flesh and blood? It's kind of like Bigfoot, you know. You don't know whether it's multidimensional, if it's a different dimension, if it's flesh and blood. And it's something where, okay, if you can photograph it, does it make it flesh and blood? Or is it the energy that's impinging on the camera that's causing it to have some kind of three-dimensional something that you see on film? Do you hear anything? And some people have asked me, did she hear anything? Several people in the family hear a humming, kind of like a very low tone in the background. And they said that usually it's preceded by complete silence. And I'll go into the next book because there's a similarity here that's uncanny. There's a complete silence so that everything around them is muted to the point where, you know, you're not hearing anything at all, the sounds of the night. Like normally you go outside, you hear frogs. Or if the window is open, maybe you might hear creatures of the night, whatever they may be, cicadas or whatever. They said that usually before it shows, it becomes deadly quiet. Deadly quiet. Almost like they're in a totally different dimension or time is somehow suspended.
That's pretty powerful. You know, is there, when they have those moments, does everything else around them seem to stop? Are they able to move about in that environment as well?
I think they sense that things seem to stop. And then there's a sense of foreboding or some kind of sense of malice. You know, if you're thinking about like a small child who is afraid of what's coming out of the closet, there's a sense of aloneness, a sense of being out of touch. Does that answer your question?
It does. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
When you hear stories like this and people bring tales to you, how skeptically do you examine these cases? Or do you try to remain completely open to them and you know, walk me through that process for you?
Well, I was trained as a therapist, and I don't know if people know that. Previous to the fact that I was a school counselor, I was actually trained as a therapist, and I worked in an inpatient unit. During that time, I learned how to interview people. I learned how to glean whether they were, as they would call it, confabulating. You know, a common word would be whether they're lying. What motive do they have to tell me these things is the next question I have. Is there any kind of evidence of them trying to either gain profit, get attention, you know, whatever it might be? So those are the elements that I think of when someone chooses to open up and tell me these kinds of stories. Now, to date, I haven't used anyone's real name. Even in the current book that I'm writing, all the names are all, you know, pretty much anonymous. I've created names because they don't want to be identified. No one's been paid. and really, certainly, you know, when it goes out to the world at large, you know, no one, I don't think anyone would want to disclose who they are after it's read. Because, yeah, people will question, is this a person who's got you know, a full deck? You know, have they lost their marbles? So they actually stand to lose more than gain by coming forward and telling me. So I look at that. And then in the case of the current book, and even in the previous book, I try to see if the story changes over time. I try to see if the person adds on something that wasn't in the original story. I look at the number of witnesses around them that have seen it. There's still a number of people alive in the story in the first half of the book, as there are in the second half, where I go through chapter by chapter different cases that I'm aware of. You know, some I keep in touch with, some through time I, you know, lost track of.
Mm-hmm.
But in all of them, there was one in the later half of the book about something that happened close to here. And no one wants to be identified. Other than where it took place, I really changed everything or had to change everything. There was one that was a prominent person in the community that really was very reluctant to come forward and share a story. So I changed the elements, some of it. Stuck to the facts, but then changed the name, changed the location a little bit so that no one would be able to identify it. There are some that are real locations because they're so far away. And it's interesting because now, because there's so many people, it's overpopulated, they would never be able to find that particular house or that particular townhouse that I'm talking about.
Well, and I appreciate you protecting the innocent and the storylines, but getting them out there, because really it doesn't matter where or who, but just sharing the experience. And I'm sure that's got to help people that read your books to feel not so alone in their journey with the strange and the supernatural.
Well, I hope so. I really do, because I think that there's a lot of people out there that are very cynical and tend to ridicule people. And because of that, people won't tell. And when that happens, you know, people who experience things of this nature, some of them are pretty traumatized. And if you can't talk to anyone at all about it, it makes it even more traumatic, in my belief. And through the years, you know, I've noticed that there's a change, you know, through the pandemic. I've noticed that there's a change. There seems to be more receptivity to it. And if you look at current programming, there's shows out there like Evil, to cite one, that's about the idea of a demonic force that have to be exorcised. There's shows out there like Stranger Things, which I think is fascinating. Too bad it's not on the air anymore, but that's one. And then you've got shows that deal with alternate realities. I don't know if you're familiar with the show Manifest. That one was pulled off the air. I think it's going back on Netflix for a season. But these things come about because there's now an audience that's willing to watch them and not think of them basically as comedy or something way, way out there. It might be in the fringe, but there's always, you know, as they say, when there's smoke, there's fire.
Do you believe that, you know, I guess I should put it this way. Obviously, you've looked into UFOs and demonic forces and ghosts and things. Is there something under the collective umbrella of the paranormal that you have trouble understanding or buying into?
I don't know if it's a matter of buying into it, Dave. I think the word that I'm grappling with, or at least trying to get people to do. And I've seen this in Facebook forums. I've seen comments on Twitter. I've seen a lot of social media. People tend to approach, as investigators, distinct and disparate phenomena that might actually be overlapping with each other. And when I say that, I mean, I'm saying this kindly and nicely, to be politically correct. This is my thought process, that if someone is investigating something and they're of the persuasion that it could be something that's three-dimensional, something that's breathing, something that impinges on our reality, is it possible that it can also go into a different reality? Could its nature be in such a way that it has the capacity to become invisible? People who look at Bigfoot as flesh and blood. And I'm not going to bias the audience because I have an idea what it is.
No. This show is all about biasing our audience. We want to hear everybody's thoughts and concerns. So please, Anna, don't pull back on us now. What do you think Bigfoot is?
I can just imagine the comments. So what do I think? I've never met Bigfoot, okay? I have no experience other than one case in my book about Bigfoot, okay? And I really had to sit down with this woman and say, did you see it? Did you actually see it? Or was it just a farmer across the field that saw it? Said, no, I actually saw it with my own eyes. And the way it was running on 2 feet. Okay, so I always kind of pull back because I want to know that who I'm talking to is actually someone that, you know, is logical, is, as you would say, sane. What do I believe? I think it's very odd to me.
First of all, I have to say, we have to be cautious because the nuts are my favorite conversations, to be honest with you. And sometimes I yield more information talking to the cuckoo birds than I do the people that are rational, because I love the insight of why people believe the things they are.
Yeah. And a lot of it is because of their own background,
right.
The lens that they wear, and I don't mean physically, but, you know, the way they've been trained to see. And in the particular case of Bigfoot, I hear stories, okay, and these are only stories that I read. I've never been on an investigation with Bigfoot. I don't know that I want to be. The thing moves way too fast for me, faster than I can run. Anything like that, I don't know, Dave. I really don't know that I would ever be prepared. But I hear it's flesh and blood. That's one camp. I hear it's multidimensional. That's another camp. And then the third camp says that when we see these things, other things tend to happen. We sight UFOs. You know, we see other anomalous events. So what does that tell me? They might be, you know, one huge paranormal, one huge supernatural corridor of which there are several doors on either side. And when you open the one door, you're probably also opening the other doors.
So what do you believe then? Do you believe that this is a flesh and blood creature, or do you believe it's interdimensional, or is it a ghost, or is it all three? Is it a ghost, interdimensional flesh and blood being? What? You've got me confused, Anna. I need to know.
I don't know, Dave. I only have one case. I really don't feel qualified to discuss Bigfoot, to tell you the truth, because of only one case. The rest of what I've read is basically me reading through the lens of another writer, another investigator. I've never investigated him. What I will conjecture, and I will safely say this, conjecture is the word I want to use, is that if you have something that's being sighted and it is destroying property, okay, shook the trailer, jumped up on the roof, caused damage, it's obviously three-dimensional, okay? I mean, other than a poltergeist that bangs things around and shuts off the light and whatever, this thing is out in the woods and it pursues people. It can hurt people, from what I understand. They're very elusive, but they can also kill dogs, destroy the trailer, and whatever else. So it's three-dimensional. But why is it that something else comes along with it, like some people have cited UFOs, when this thing is around? Probably because it's a missing link and because it has the ability, perhaps, and this is just conjecture, that it can use telepathy to talk to otherworldly beings, things that are higher on the dimensional scale. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay. All right.
Am I crazy? Maybe I am. I don't know.
Don't discount yourself. It's not maybe. You definitely are crazy, but we like that about you. But we're all a little touched here. This is the safe place for the crazies and the illogical and the thinking to come together and discuss these topics without judgment, at least not publicly. Right?
Thank you.
That's the whole concept. It's opening up the paradigms. Listen, it's creating conversation. It's better than fighting over your president, my president, mask mandates, news. I would rather debate all day long about what Bigfoot is than talk about mask mandates and vaccines, although you should take them. That's all I'm going to say. Oh, geez, Tim, did you just hear the amount of angry texts that began and emails right with one little comment?
I can hear the arthritis building up in people's fingers right now. Yes.
Yeah.
Gosh.
All right, let's do this. We have to take a quick break. Check out the book, Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences. It was re-released May 15th, 2021 with new stories and updated. We have a link for that book in today's program information, or just go to darknessradio.com, click on the shop tab, and then go into our Amazon store in the paranormal book section. You'll see all the great books we feature right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. You're listening to Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. Thank you very much for tuning in, being a part of our world. This is the best in paranormal podcasting. How do I know? Because Tim's mom and my mom told us, and they're not apt to lie. We want to also remind you this Friday, September 10th, that's tomorrow, folks, make sure you check out Discovery Plus, The Curse of Lizzie Borden. That's right. I went in to investigate the Lizzie Borden murder house with Chris Fleming, Sam Beltrusis, a relative of Lizzie Borden, and Luann Jolly to investigate the strange curse surrounding the Borden family and what could have caused the murders. We hope that you'll tune in and check it out. Stay for the entire episode. We have some very powerful moments throughout the investigation. I think will truly shape some of the way that you look at this case and the history and story of it. So make sure, again, you check out The Curse of Lizzie Borden on Discovery Plus. And that is tomorrow, September 10th. If you're listening to this Friday, it's not tomorrow, September 11th. It's today, the 10th. But thank God Discovery Plus still has it up on their website, so you can watch it anytime. And please watch it and watch it multiple times. Call your neighbors, your friends, your relatives. Tell them to watch the show. Help support your old pal Darkness Dave by doing that. Coming out this, I think, November, Tim, I will be doing a shock doc. You'll see me pop up as a talking head regarding the demons of the White House, or ghosts of the White House, or something paranormal to do with the White House. I'm not quite sure what the title of it is, but as soon as I know, I will let you know. But I'll be on those two shock docs. Another good reason to keep Discovery Plus if you haven't already signed up for it. And I'm going to give one more piece of advice. I've mentioned it before. I'll mention it again. But Dave, I don't want to spend an extra $5 to $7 a month for Discovery Plus. Take the free week. There's a free week you get to subscribe. Look at all of the programming that's under Discovery Plus. You might find that 90% of the shows you watch are there. It may behoove you to try that. You could drop cable or contact your cable company, tell them you're tired of overpaying, and see if they can rework your structure. And most times I find that they'll drop the price $20 to $30 to keep you as a happy customer for what you already have. And sometimes they even add on more. So that $20 to $30 you just saved per month, now for $5 you can get Discovery Plus with commercials. $7 a month gets you all of the great programming on Discovery Plus commercial free. And it has like 20 channels, history channels, true crime channels, paranormal channels, travel, food, you want it. It's all under that umbrella. Tens of thousands of hours of programming. So check it out. Our guest today, Anna Maria Manalo, we're talking about her past book, Portal, A Lifetime of Paranormal Experiences, and teasing her new book, The Way Through the Woods, A Child's Escape Through the Haunted Forests of World War II Germany. I want to talk a little bit more about that new book that you're working on that should be coming out this fall, and certainly we'll put up links for it. But and I understand that you write this is all based on true factual stories and encounters, but you are changing names in some of the direct locations as not to overrun them or cause embarrassment for the people involved. When you hear a story like this and you start working on uncovering it, do you ever find strange things start to occur around you while writing these type of books?
You're asking me.
Yeah, because Tim didn't write a book called The Way Through the Woods, Child's Escape from the Forest of World War II Germany. Or if
he tried.
He's using the pen name Anna Maria Manalo and very this whole show.
Yeah, I tried, but it failed miserably. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me digress. Now that you asked me that question, okay, there's something called synchronicity. Well, there's two things here I want to mention. The first one is synchronicity. Back when the first edition of this book that we were just talking about came to press, I had given a couple of copies to a couple of friends. They wanted me to sign it, yada, yada, yada. And then I gave a third copy to my stepson. And he said, oh, incidentally, by the way, we're having dinner with my grandmother, yada, yada, yada. And would you like to come along? And I said, sure. And so we went to this huge, huge Chinese restaurant that had like a menu that was probably, it was like a Bible. It was so thick, it took us half an hour just to go through it to figure out what we want. But to make a long story short, since I tend to talk forever, the woman that I met is a grandmother now. At the time of, you know, all these things that were happening to her, the book begins when she was about 4 years old and ends when she was 14. And it starts with when Hitler started rising into power, back in the early 30s, and ends with her actually, with the Russians actually occupying Germany. And through that, she told me this in numerous interviews after the dinner was over. We sat there for a while, and I knew then I had to reach out to her over and over. And it's interesting because before that dinner had happened, just a week before, I was talking to people about how I wanted to delve more deeply into having a book that had one story about a person's life and how it changed them because of all the supernatural occurrences that they had to go through. So this second book is different from the first in that where I had two parts to the first book, devoting the story of one family all the way to page or chapter 24. This one actually goes through the entire book, talking in detail about her supernatural experiences. So my main witness is still alive today, and she just turned 90. Her daughter told me she was 93. She just turned 90. The poor woman was getting older. And the uncanny part about this is that it really crystallizes to us that no matter what dimension you're in, I mean, obviously, I believe in multiple dimensions. You tend to impinge upon another dimension of existence. And that's the cornerstone of this book, is that war is hard on people, so much so that they have to bear witness to the suffering that they went through, even after they've passed away, obviously in a tragic manner. So that's what this book is about. And so that, you know, there's the two things, the synchronicity of encountering people that were just around the corner from me that gave me the story, and then the whole idea with multiple dimensions in operation in the same space and time.
Do you believe that?
Does that make sense?
It does. Do you believe that because of the conflict that was taking there, the war, the psychological and spiritual scarring of that area led to all of this unbelievable supernatural activity? Or do you believe that this place was already filled with it prior to World War II?
Well, I think it might be both. I mean, you got to remember, you know, the setting is in Europe. You know, we're looking at Germany in particular, and I'm not by any means a historian because I really didn't go beyond 1900 to see what happened in Germany at the time. But I'm sure that there's a lot of things historically, a lot of bloodshed, a lot of wars that happened. You know, even World War One was even bloodier than World War Two, and even before World War One. You know, we had all these different things that were going on through the millennia. What I think has happened with, you know, countries, not just Germany, obviously, although Germany is the focus here, is that you have one violent event layering after another. And the most violent one has the capacity to elicit all the other negative energy that's already been imbued into that environment. In this case, there's a series of forests that this girl had to go through and her father had to go through. These are the two people that are the main people. The father I didn't get to interview because he has already passed away way, way back, but the girl. And I think what's happening is you've got the interspersal of all the negative energies coming together. And you just won't believe.
And that's kind of creating this rift. Well, can you, you know, tease it a little bit for us? Obviously, we're talking about it now. It won't be out until later on in the fall. People will have forgotten those tidbits of it by then. They'll pick up the book simply because Tim and I are maestros of publicity and manipulation of our our feeble-minded audience. I kid. But what are some of the strange aspects that took place that really kind of captured your attention during the telling of the story?
Okay, so this one was, what happened essentially was that the family was torn apart. Her mother was caught hiding a child who was disabled. And she was basically taken away. She doesn't know what happened to her mother. No idea. The neighbor down the street who was hiding the daughter and ended up hiding it in their house also got in trouble and also promptly disappeared. Later on in the book, as the girl's father is going through the forest in quest of her daughter. The daughter escaped the Nazi youth corps. And when I say that, there was Nazi youth that were being trained. Children as young as, you know, if they were being given up, as young as age four, being indoctrinated into the Reich and books by Hitler. Anything that he wrote, anything he stood for, they were kind of being brainwashed. By age 12, you were required as a German child to join the youth corps. My witness had to join by age 12, even though her father was against it. Her mother was against it. There was a lot of Germans, civilians, families that were totally against the Nazis. They had to remain quiet for obvious reasons. But this family was pretty prominent. He was a very successful tailor. And then suddenly, because of what happened to the disabled child and because they were caught hiding them, he was forced to go into an army installation and forced to work there without pay as a tailor, which is mild because he was reputable and they needed him to make uniforms. So the key there was that he was needed, so he was allowed to live. Meanwhile, my witness was taken away and sent to a woman who ran the youth corps. She was sequestered in her house. She was teaching all these things that she didn't believe in. And then one day, finally, she escapes to look for her father. And that's where all the paranormal stuff begins, because then she goes through the forests. One of the things the father encounters is that he is going through an area. At this point, he's by himself. He's already escaped the installation. And as he proceeds south, the forest gets deeper and deeper. And as it gets deeper, it becomes very, very quiet, very remote. He's foraging for food. And then he comes across a clearing where there's a river. He parts the trees. He looks out. It's probably about nightfall. There's a whole line of German soldiers wearing boots, helmets. They've got their rifles. And they have lined up along the river a whole group of village people. There were men, women, elderly, small children, people of every description. And he witnesses a firing squad. And they all simultaneously drop to the ground, blood jettisons all over the place, the river turns red. They're screaming. One soldier walks over and starts shooting someone who obviously is still alive. But at the end of the line of soldiers is a young man. He takes off his hat. He looks totally in shock. He drops his rifle. He takes out a gun from his boots. And he walks over towards Horst, who is my witness's father. Horst, for a minute, thinks, oh my gosh, the man is seeing me. He's going to shoot me. So he tries to hide in the underbrush. And just a few feet away, as the soldier reaches him, he shoots himself in the head and drops dead, and brain matter, pieces of skull scatter all over the place, all over Horst and all over his clothing. Mm-hmm. He was only a few feet away. So then he, you know, he's very sick now, physically sick from what he's seen, totally in shock. He turns away. And as he's running, he was up on the ridge. He rolls off the ridge and then collapses. He wakes up and it's morning. And he recalls suddenly what had just happened that he had witnessed the night before. So he looks down at his clothing and he notices there was no blood, no brain matter. It was just nothing but sweat. He was exhausted from walking and he wonders what's going on. He climbs up back on the ridge, looks through the trees, and there's nothing there. Walks through the underbrush, walks up a few paces, he sees the river, and there's nothing there. Now, the river is kind of distant in comparison to where that young soldier the night before walked over, kind of like walking away from his regiment. So he's looking around, The only thing he saw on the ground was something that was glinting. He didn't know what it was. So he leans down and he picks it up. and it was some type of metal. Obviously, army. And it had dried blood all over it. And that was the only cue he had that something had happened there.
Powerful. Boy, what a strange set of circumstances. And to see this, to be eyewitness to these moments in history and survive that, that's powerful. And then to have shared this with your child, and how did she seem in relating these stories to you?
She was, I think at that point, because time had passed. I mean, he told her all this when they finally got to the U.S. They ended up in Philadelphia. I think they went through New York and then ended up in Philadelphia. He finally told her, because she was telling him what she had seen, what she had experienced, and hers was a lot more intense, Dave. And if he hadn't been the first person to hear about it, people would have told her she was crazy. So he reassured her after hearing what happened. And then he started telling her what happened to him. And this is one of those stories he told her. But with the passage of time, I think it was more like, I'm trying to remember what happened first, kind of a thing. You know, because remember, she's much older now.
Right.
So she had a sense of detachment that I thought, you know, meanwhile, my jaw was hanging down. But to her, it was almost like, okay, I did tell my daughter this. I remember I even told her, you know, kind of like a, you know, treasure the moments when you're alive and things are peaceful, because you can't take for granted that things are always peaceful, that you will always have food. You know, she remembers things like the mushrooms that were edible. She remembers the scent of death. She remembers how quiet things became right before she experienced something different. But at the time, she didn't know what those things meant. She just knew that she felt almost in despair, and she didn't know why. She knew circumstances were dire. But even more, there was a layering of something almost telling her to give up. And then there were places that were more lonelier than other places that somehow changed in the light of day.
Right.
And she would avoid those little places.
Just out of curiosity, speaking to this woman, understanding how powerful consciousness is, memory is, and psychological scars, do you believe that there was any disassociative behavior in the sense that maybe what she thinks was represented by the supernatural was more human atrocity, that she was, you know, seeing the things that you see during World War II and how things unraveled? Do you think she maybe ascribed some of these moments to something supernatural as opposed to allowing herself to believe humans could do this to one another?
I think she was in shock that it was really as bad as it was, because she was sheltered as a child and things unraveled because they were hiding a disabled child. She never could believe, and to this day, she says to me, I can't believe how cruel people can become, but I guess they are. So I think there's more that she hasn't told me, Dave. I just get the sense sometimes that she's holding back something else. because I
would guess that would be hard to process. And sometimes your mind just doesn't, you know, it's easy to look back and, on the past and view it through rose-colored glasses of youth or naivete. But then when you've got all of this negativity, sometimes I wonder if you felt, did it become, you know, come from a bugaboo into a monster because of time and the way it is? Or does the mind sometimes hide it and make it less horrible than it really was as well?
Right, right. I mean, there was a point when her father and mother had been moved to this mansion. And it was very obvious that whoever lived there had been forcibly taken out of their home, leaving all their clothes and, oh my gosh, antiques. It was a very high-end house. It had three floors. And she was telling me it was just beautiful, but who would ever leave it? And she said, I realized later on, it's not that they left it voluntarily. It's that they were torn from it. Like they didn't deserve to live there. And she had a sense of discomfort about it, but her mother was trying to insulate her from what might have happened to that family until she herself saw something in the middle of the night when she was retiring to bed. She also relied a lot on her mother to interpret things for her and explain things to her. And this was a journey for her because by the end, she was processing on her own what had happened. In the beginning, she was relying on her mother to explain to her why things were the way they were. So really, it was a growth. It was a growth process for her as a person, as a human being. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. You know, she heard these experiences from the people she cared about and trusted most. Do you think that that influenced her own memories, though, to what happened? And what was one of the most compelling, as we're wrapping up our interview here today, what was one of the most compelling things that happened to her directly that was supernaturally based?
When she interacted with a disabled girl that she treated like her sister for a number of days and then realized she was interacting with the dead.
Yeah, that would definitely be powerful, right? I mean, to know that happened. I mean, the children seem innocent and adept at having those moments, at connecting and sometimes not even realizing it. When she looked back at those moments, was it like the movie The Sixth Sense? Did pieces suddenly fall in place? Oh my God, yeah. How could I have not seen this was a dead girl? Or what was that moment of realization really like for her? Did she go into that with you?
She sort of delved into why the girl spent those moments with her. And she felt like somehow because her life was just simply torn, they were separated by force, that the girl was saying goodbye. She thought that people couldn't come back from the grave. But it made a believer out of her that they could.
Right.
And she couldn't believe that she could have such an involved experience. And she believes to this day that when people, not to be trite, but when people have a bond, when they love each other, that it does last beyond the grave. And she thinks that's why this girl had reached out to her in the way that she did. It was just one way to bear witness to the atrocity, but also to be able to say, I live on. And I'm okay.
Yeah, I get that. That's powerful. How did writing this book impact you regarding, you know, I guess in contrast to sharing your own stories from the first book?
This was more involved, Dave. This was because I was writing down what she was saying, and I was using an entire notebook page by page to chronicle the events. I actually had, you know, and I never really use an outline, but I had an outline for this one. But as I came across it, it kind of hit me on the gut that this was a very profound experience.
Right.
Not just for the person who walked through that life, but also for the person who was writing it.
Gotcha.
I mean, there's moments of lightness, you know, and moments of joy in the book, but there's also a lot of moments of just terror, sheer terror. She never knew what was going to come up to her the next day. She never knew. And then there was a sense of impermanence, obviously. After a while, she started to disbelieve what she was experiencing.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, right? Because it's you kind of are in that fugue state that this is just so outlandish and so surreal that it can't be true. And you have to wonder, you're being pushed to the limits because of war. You know, the brain is a powerful tool and it can manipulate and can twist your perceptions of a lot of things. It can blind you to some things and make you more vulnerable to others.
And, you know, Dave, the sad part about it is that there was never a time when, other than, you know, her sharing all her experiences with her daughter, being able to kind of debrief, so to speak, with her father when they got to the U.S., there was really no talk of any kind of therapy. I mean, when you think about post-traumatic stress disorder and what it means to witness these types of things.
Right.
That had happened in the past. No one is there to really listen to her. She processed this all on her own with just her family.
That's going to be tough.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking stuff. Anna Maria, thank you so much for sharing your personal insights and to bring this story to light, because I think it's going to be important. And we wish you a lot of success with the release of the new book. For our listeners, again, we have a link to her first book. The new updated version is on our website. If you go to the shop tab, click on our Amazon store, go in there, it's underneath the paranormal books. It'll be one of the newest books, and you'll find all the books that we cover on the program there as well. Stay safe. Thank you so much for joining us. And folks, remember tomorrow, September 10th, on Discovery Plus, The Curse of Lizzie Borden. Go check out that new shock doc that I was a part of. It will be on tomorrow. And hopefully in the next week or two, we're going to have a special bonus episode. We'll do a Darkness Radio Live with a few of the participants from that documentary to talk about the case, talk about the stories and the history regarding it. So that's it for today and this week. Thank you for tuning into the best in paranormal podcasting. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and you've been listening to Darkness Radio.